This Be Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate, so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K through 12th grade curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. If you want to bring IXL to your school, you can learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. We're proud to be sponsored by MyFlex Learning. MyFlex Learning is a scheduling platform that helps middle and high schools meet the individual needs of all students. Schools can easily create and manage time for flex blocks, activity periods, RTI, therapy, and teacher appointments, and much more. With its built-in accountability tool and reporting features, MyFlex Learning solves your challenges around getting kids where they need to be and understanding how flex time is spent. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. This is Dr. Karen, and you are listening to the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network, where I share up-to-date, evidence-based practices, my own experiences, and guest interviews designed to help pediatric therapists, educators, and aspiring school leaders design services that support social, emotional, and academic growth and set kids up for success in adulthood. Whether you want to learn effective strategies for your therapy session or classroom, be an influential leader on your team, or find creative ways to use your skills to advance in your career, I've got you covered. Hey there, it's Dr. Karen, and welcome to episode 153 of the De Facto Leaders Podcast. Our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors don't have to define us. This is an important thing to remember for adults dealing with professional burnout and compassion fatigue, and it's also important to model for kids. When school discipline focuses on punitive measures alone, we miss out on opportunities to teach kids how to manage emotions or repair mistakes. That's why I'm so excited to share this second half of my conversation with Chrissy Mombella in episode 153, where we talk about the importance of debriefing, maintaining safe school communities, and teaching kids how to restore relationships. Chrissy is the program director for the REACH Initiative through the Partnership for Resilience. She leads the REACH Communities of Practice, and her work allows her to be a thought partner and leader in the implementation and evaluation of the REACH Initiative, a strategic partnership with the Center for Childhood Resilience at Lurie Children's Hospital, and the support of the Illinois State Board of Education. With over 25 years of public education experience as a special ed teacher and administrator, Chrissy's focus is on developing systems that support connection, innovation, and belonging within school communities. Chrissy earned her bachelor's with a concentration in special ed from Northern Illinois University and her master's in educational administration from Loyola University. And just so you are aware before you listen, in this conversation, we discuss some sensitive topics relating to traumatic events in schools. So just be aware as you go through this conversation that there is some sensitive material. So in this conversation, we discuss why does skipping the debrief after a crisis situation increase the likeliness of compassion fatigue? Things like crisis prevention and how we can take a proactive approach to de-escalation, the impact of social emotional learning for adults and why it's not just about the kids, restoring a safe community after physical altercations between students, minimizing re-traumatization during the debriefing process, teaching relationship repair and the impact it has on the well-being of all parties involved. And finally, why debriefing should be a part of all crisis drills that are done in the school setting. Many of the topics that we cover in this episode are related to what I show you how to do in the School of Clinical Leadership, my program that helps related service providers guide their teams to support students' executive functioning across the day. So executive functioning is really important to self-regulation, which ties in to the conversation about social-emotional learning, as well as the idea of restoring and repairing relationships, and the importance of modeling this for kids, as well as teaching them to regulate and learning how to regulate ourselves as well. When we think about executive functioning, it's not just about the direct intervention piece, it's about the entire system that we're working in. And that can be super challenging in that related service provider role, but you can make an impact when you have the right plan and system. So that's why the School of Clinical Leadership helps you to plan direct therapy, but also helps you to lead change on your school team, no matter your job title. You can learn more about the School of Clinical Leadership at drkarendudekbrandon.com/clinical-leadership. I start this episode in the middle of the conversation, but I did leave some overlap just so you can get a little bit of the context for what we're talking about here. But again, be sure to check out episode 152 for the complete story of what Chrissy is talking about. She is sharing a really powerful story about how she was able to engage her students by getting them involved with contributing to their community, as well as embedding social emotional learning into the entire school day. So now please enjoy this second part of my conversation with Chrissy Mombella.
So kids who were disengaged, I mean, flat affect, were like, we're not interested in this. That's what I saw at the end of seventh grade. By eighth grade, they're staying after school, helping me box, you know, food to give to whoever purchased things. They're working with me in the middle of the day, doing stuff, making sure the orders are ready. They're putting out commercials. They're creating, like, kids who supposedly, here are kids with disabilities that they're struggling, they can't manage. And this particular student completely fell off the radar for looking at therapeutic placement. What did I do? I created an engagement experience that they had voice in, they had choice in. I also taught them about like how they learn, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. They gave me feedback. And I modeled behaviors for them throughout the course of the year. And if I was frustrated, I didn't physically show my frustration. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is I wasn't yelling. I didn't change my face because facial expressions make a whole world of difference. I instead talked to them about it. You know, sometimes I would have the social worker with me or I'd have the speech pathologist and we would talk it through in circle and talk about those experiences. And they would have space then for me, like I would give them a feedback survey in the middle of the year, like at the end of the quarter, asking them what I could do differently to help them. So I gave them those opportunities and you can do that at any age, even for little ones. What's helpful, what's not helpful. It helps to make them self-aware. And so when you're doing all those things and navigating that, then that helps to prevent and reduce the behavior, the explosive behavior. But let's say we do have that explosive behavior, regardless of all those things, it still right. does. Still used to have, like when I went into an administrative role and I'm helping in those crisis situations, I'd have students who would like kick my leg and I'm like, oh. They're kicking hard and you're like, okay, I can either react and meet them at that frustration or model for them how to be calm and how to regulate. And then afterwards I would ask, after we would get the student to be calm, and sometimes that took a long time, and sometimes yes, we did have to have the classroom leave because it was taking longer than we would want it to, but we would have the kids like say goodbye, like we would, you know, if the kids were leaving the classroom, they would still reassure that individual and they would go to another space. So we had an alternative space for them to learn. And I would ask for a debrief. And I didn't always get that debrief. And the reason I didn't get that debrief is they would say, we're too busy. There's something else going on. But here's the problem with that. If you don't debrief after a situation, you're contributing to your compassion fatigue and you're contributing to your burnout. I think this is essential, just so you know, because, and I think it was 2019, ProPublica came out for Illinois in particular about the use of seclusion and restraints in schools. And it was a harsh, you know, story, and it was big. And we even had a state senator talk about his experience with seclusion and restraint as a child and how profoundly impacted he was by it. And so, you know, CPI, crisis prevention intervention, it originally was framed around here are all of these debriefing. I mean, like the bulk of it, I would say 95% of it is around de-escalation, getting into a space of calm, getting into a space of where you're able to regulate and be able to return to whatever you're doing. And the last part of it was like, if you are that unsafe, here are potential physical restraints you could do.
That was always my experience with CPI training was, the very, very end of the day, you would practice the physical restraints, but the majority was de-escalation and
The
debriefing.
majority, yes. And really, it was around how do I keep myself physically safe? That was the last part of it, right? Well, here's where we're thinking about, like I mentioned earlier, I always look at how things integrate. How do things all come together? If an adult, that adult social emotional learning foundation isn't there, adult gets trained on this. If an adult is in a dysregulated state, if they are in a frustrated state, having to deal with whatever they're dealing with, if their amygdala is hijacked, because any of us can have an amygdala hijacked, if their amygdala is hijacked, all of that de-escalation is also out the window for them. And unless they are very self-aware and have the self-management to return to having the effective coping mechanisms, they're going to go into that space in fight or flight as well. And the likelihood is greater that the first defense is going to be restraint versus the last, because they're in fight or flight too. And I noticed that I had situations in which a teacher's like, I want to be CPI trained because I'm not taking this anymore. You're like, whoa, I'm
Yeah,
not
that's
sure. I'm not sure. Like, this isn't you becoming a bouncer. Like, this is really about
Oh,
like
yeah.
being intentional about how to help support a child. And that was where I had, as an administrator, my own misstep is that if somebody's coming to me with that type of of reaction or, you know, like what or mindset, then it's up to me as an administrator to pause and go, okay, let's talk this through. Because if we're coming into it as adults from a space of frustration, there's some resistance there then to the debrief or the de-escalation strategy part of it. And what that usually means then is that you're in some type of space of fear. So like Elena Aguilar has this great three-part podcast series on coaching through resistance. And the reason I bring it up is because that it is very much about connecting to our basic human needs of belonging, connection, security. And if we're in a space of fear, or if we're in a space of I as an adult am not sure how to handle this, then we can easily become hijacked ourselves. If you have a child who is dysregulated, is disruptive, and you are in that space to have to support them, and you do, and you're able to model for them how, you're doing the co-regulation, you're able to model for them how to become calm, how to safely get out of that survival state and get into that emotional executive state where they're like, whew, I'm ready. I'm in my frontal lobe now. You've gotten me out of freeze, fight or freeze, and now I'm in my frontal lobe. My rational thinking has finally kicked in. So I'm able to do this again. Afterwards, to avoid the Groundhog Day repeating, because sometimes when kids get dysregulated, you're dealing with that then almost every day in some way. You debrief. And a debrief is whoever was in the space working with that child at the beginning of the situation to the end of the situation, they come together and they talk about what was the trigger, what happened that caused this child to become that disruptive and that dysregulated. What helped? What worked? What didn't work? What might we need to do differently next time? Because when you're able to talk it through rationally, then it helps to know, like, okay, I'm seeing this pattern. I'm seeing this trend. And it's not necessarily just like, if you look at it from a disability standpoint, we often think about functional behavioral assessments mm-hmm. and intervention plans. What was the antecedent? You know, what was the triggering event? All of those pieces. If we can get clear in that, it's not always time of day. It's sometimes a tapping into what they might perceive as a deficit within themselves, whether it's a new activity, whether mm-hmm. the transition occurred when it wasn't supposed to, whether, you know, they might be having trouble sharing, or they came off of lunch recess and they're coming in and they had a hard time before they even entered the space. You start to see some patterns, some trends. And if you can do that in the debriefing, the other thing to ask in that debriefing is how is everyone doing? What do you need? And that's for everyone to ask themselves, because especially like I think about general education teachers, if they're in a space with a child who is or is not disabled and they just had this type of event, their brain is going into that process of, I got to keep all my students safe. I got to keep myself safe. How am I going to be responsible for all of the academic learning that's mm-hmm. supposed to take place? I'm going to have all these parents calling me, trying to find out what's going on for their child. Like they're spinning because they have to do all those things. So if we're in a space of like, what support do you need? That debrief can help with the compassion fatigue and burnout. If the administrator wasn't in the physical space, but they're in that debriefing, they can now become a support and an ally versus handle it or figure it out, you know, or getting frustrated that the child is doing what they're doing. Because, for example, with like the suspensions and expulsions, like I mentioned on 100, if you don't know the alternative, which is restorative, which is to restore, repair the situation, the relationship.
Yeah.
If you're not familiar with how to do that repair, then you default to what you know, which right now, zero tolerance and punitive and compliance-based discipline is the focus. So you might call the parent up as an administrator and say, we're really struggling. We don't know what to do. So-and-so is struggling and all of these other pieces. The parent or the caregiver may say, you know what? I'll come pick them up. I'll help out. And if they do that, that's still a suspension.
Mm-hmm.
Because you went along with it and you let them leave for no reason other than their behavior.
Yes.
That's still a suspension. And here's the thing. If that worked, if the parent or caregiver said, oh, I'll take them, and then they take them, and you might be tempted to do it again. But by the third or fourth time, that parent or caregiver is like, look, I might have been available before, but I'm working. This is really hard. I can't keep picking them up. You're going to need to figure this out. If you don't talk to the parent after, or the caregiver after that type of incident that I talked about, the explosive incident, and include them in this problem-solving process, if you wait until it gets to be an overload, then you're not getting the reciprocity you're looking for. You're going to get defensiveness. Your frustration is going to be met with defensiveness, and it's going to create a cycle of frustration for everyone involved. And then that's when it becomes harder, because if a child has a disability, you at least have the protections and supports of IDEA, excuse me, to work with. You at least have special ed to help guide you and have the services. So, you know, therapeutic placements are available as young as preschool. But if you have a child who's disruptive and you don't have the collaboration and partnership with the parent or caregiver, and they don't have an IEP, therapeutic placements are not available. Alternative programming is not available. I believe it does not begin until around junior high. So you have pre-K through five. If a parent's like, no, I'm not signing for special ed, or I'm not signing for an evaluation, or I don't agree to services, then you are working with that child. And expulsion is really that's a big one to do at that young an age.
Right. And it's I think a lot of people feel like they're, if services aren't an option, then, I mean, I think they feel like those things like suspension and expulsion are their options that they're dealing with or that they have. So how do you handle it with, for example, if there was an incident between two students and maybe there was even a physical altercation between two students, how would debriefing look in that kind of a situation? Even if it was something that maybe happened between classes in the hallway or something like that.
So first and foremost, I will say you want to make sure that everyone who's involved is ready to be involved. And what I mean by that is that regulation.
Yeah.
So because here's what happens. Let's say two kids get into a fight and you ask them after the fight, you've broken them up. They're probably in two separate spots in the office or they might, whatever space they're in. And you say, what happened? Almost always you'll get, you get like a shrug. Mm-hmm. You not even get words. Or you have a kid who's like, blah, 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 they did blah, blah, blah. And it's the other person who did something, they weren't involved. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's the push out, deflect, defensiveness, or it's the silence, shrugging shoulders, non-responsive. Mm-hmm. That, when I would see that, that would tell me that that individual was not in a space of being able to share with me what was going on, or they didn't feel safe enough to do so. Because safety in schools, we think about physical safety, but in reality, there is emotional safety. And as I was learning in the last few years of my administrative experience, psychological safety. And the more I delved into the emotional and psychological safety, the more I better understood like why sometimes kids won't do work. Their creativity is gone because they're not feeling emotionally or psychologically safe for the output. Mm-hmm. And so this is the same situation. If a student is not in a good space to know to trust that I can talk with this person about it, then it's not going to work. Sometimes it helps to have, like, if the child has a relationship with the social worker or the psychologist or has a relationship with an adult in the building, having that person ask the question of what happened is probably going to get you a better response, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. If it's between two students, I would do that with the second child as well, for both of them, right? Once that situation is handled and you find out more and you investigate, and that takes time and that's hard, you know, because that's a lot of time that an administrator or whomever is involved is navigating for this. Well, then in order to repair it, the likelihood is great that these two students are in classes together or they're going to be in shared spaces together. It's not like it's going to go away.
Yeah.
So how do you do something where there's like maybe peer mediation? Sometimes there's peer juries so that like the peers can listen in and like, and take into consideration. I would say anytime you're looking at restorative, it's so important that all the staff who are going to be involved in the restorative piece are trained in restorative practices. But really looking at how do we repair? How do we see that humanity in one another? So the students are sitting with one another, with somebody who is familiar with restorative practices and is trained. And then we're talking about how can we be in a shared space together? I'm not talking about being friends with one another. I'm not saying you have to be friends with one another, but how can we be in a shared space together so that we can learn, we can be safe, and we can be ourselves? And in some areas, depending on which communities you're working in, these might be kids who are in rival gangs outside of school. That's a reality that people are facing. Mm-hmm. How can we be in a shared space together? Because this is our school community. So it's all of our school community. How can we be in this space together? And sometimes it does involving the parents. And here's the part that's also hard with that. I was just on a call with during part of the community of practice that I have, where a teacher was explaining to me how hard it's been to teach this one particular child about not fighting. Mm-hmm. And what she shared with me was that when she asked the child, well, where did you learn that you need to do this? And the child said they got it from the parent.
I've heard of that happening.
You know, the parent said, you got to fight your way through it. You got to fight your way through it. And she's like, how do I compete with that? Like the teacher asked that. Like, mm-hmm. And it's really, it's a hard conversation, but it's a valuable one. talking to that parent or caregiver and saying, in the space that your child's in, this school community, they're part of a school community. How do you and I partner? We have different beliefs, because this is the other part that's a sticking point right now in our society. We have these extremes. You know, there's either or, it's very binary thinking. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't get us anywhere. It's not like this person's good and this person's bad. This thought is good. It is, okay, you have a belief and skills, a belief and viewpoint. I have a belief and viewpoint. Now we're in a shared space. How do we make a compromise? And
that typically you don't get everything that you want in a compromise.
No, you don't. And
yeah.
And you don't, but at the same time, you're still teaching a skill, because one of the things that I used to talk about with students all the time is there are going to be things in life that don't go your way. And that's hard. And that's frustrating, because we all want things to go our way. But how are we willing to navigate in that space, so that if it doesn't entirely go your way, but you can live with it, then that's okay too. So I think about I don't know if you've ever done this strategy. I've done this when I've done, when we're trying to reach agreement on something, it's called the fist to five. And if you have a closed fist, then you're like, nope, can't do it, won't do it. And a five is like, not only will I do it, I will share it with others. You know, three or more, it means you're at consensus. It means you're okay. You're living with it. If you're below a three, that means, okay, let's talk it through some more. Let's work through it. How do I respect you? And how do I respect me? How do we come to a point where we can respect one another? How do we help with this relationship? Are we going to agree that this is a cordial relationship, or maybe we might just do a head nod or just a wave, or are we going to actually become friends? That's also important with teachers as well, because kids, and with our students, I should say, with children, they're not necessarily thinking of, they're not carrying the weight of past experiences with that person with them into the door. Like depending on where they are at developmentally, they may not be carrying like, yesterday I had this hard day with this person, today I'm going to have a hard day.
Yeah.
May not be. But adults tend to do that.
Yeah.
And so if that's the case, we may, whether we are conscious of it or not, be preparing ourselves for the arrival of that child who is oftentimes dysregulating. So if that's the case, how do we build a relationship with that child? And one of the things that's really important about this is taking the time to get to know that child and finding things that you might have in common. And that's the restorative piece, even though you may not think it's restorative.
I wanted to take a quick break here and talk about the School of Clinical Leadership. As you're probably realizing in this conversation, social-emotional learning is something that needs to be embedded across the day. This is true for kids, and this is true for the adults as well. And this goes beyond what you need to do in your direct therapy sessions if you are a related service provider, even though that is one very important piece. So that's why in the School of Clinical Leadership, I help related service providers take a stand for themselves as leaders on their team, as well as for their students. In the program, I'll help you create a comprehensive plan for putting executive functioning support in place on your school team by giving you the tools you need to influence your team. You can learn how to become a member at drkarendudekbrennan.com/clinical leadership. Let's talk about flex time in schools. The potential benefits to our students make it worth exploring. More time for personalized learning. Increased choice and agency for students. Dedicated time for intervention. Overall, as school leaders, it gives us and our faculty more tools to increase academic achievement. But the implementation and management of flex time can be a challenge. Tricky logistics and a lack of clear accountability systems can prevent teachers from buying in and can hold us back from ensuring students make good use of their time. I'm pleased to share that MyFlex Learning provides a solution to these challenges and more. MyFlex Learning helps you create and manage flex time for any purpose. Want to see it for yourself? Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year of use. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Yeah, I think that people misunderstand it, and like people talk about it on TikTok. And so tiny little video of what this actually means. And I think that the concern that I've heard about restorative is, you know, here's a person who was maybe victimized by someone else, and you're making them debrief when, you know, that it's traumatic for that person who was the victim in that situation. And that's the primary concern. But I think that, you know, sometimes it's, well, were they implementing restorative practices effectively if that's really what's happening? And so that's the question that I have, where it's
right.
maybe that really isn't what it was supposed to be about in mm-hmm. the first place.
Right. And I think the other piece is, you know, kind of going back to that example of the two fights, like what happened, you could say to them, are you feeling safe to share with me what occurred?
Mm-hmm.
And giving them the choice. That's why I think it's so important that you're with somebody, if the child is with somebody they trust or they have mm-hmm. a relationship with, because yeah. it could be re-traumatizing, and you got to be cautious with that.
Yeah. That's the concern that I've heard yes. being brought up, because, yes. you know, and because like, I think you do want to advocate for the, you know, both children, but at the same time, you know, it's like finding the balance between, you know, if there was a physical altercation between two kids, was it finding out what actually happened and finding out, is there a child who's being bullied here repeatedly? And
yes,
it's something where like they're having to go debrief with someone who's been, you know, following them around and, you know, antagonizing them for weeks, months, whatever. And I think that that's a big concern that has been brought up, where it's, I think that sometimes people feel like, well, you know, maybe there should be a consequence for the child who is doing that over and over again. So yeah, it's yeah. tricky.
And it's really tricky. And I will say, you know, we're talking in general terms. If yeah. this is something where it's like significant, where mm-hmm. if a physical fight versus physical assault are two mm-hmm. different, that's yeah. a little different, right?
Yeah.
There are degrees, and that's where language is really important, and making sure, like, okay, how do we make sure that it's safe enough for them to do this as well? Because that may take some time. One of the things is we have to really be careful about like how we approach things, and we're sensitive to those things, and recognize that we can't rush into some of this. And that's what's hard. Is that in school's going to still happen. The day is still going to start. Like, the day is going to go on. So it's like, how do we make sure that we have a plan in place as to how we can do the repair and make sure that people are supported? So for example, communication is really important. You know, so I had a student who, for whatever reason, when there was a substitute, drew a gun on the chalkboard, the mm-hmm. driver's board, excuse me, and then did a stick figure of the teacher that was the recipient of that gun. There was nothing mm-hmm. else on there. It was just those two things.
Yeah.
Well, it was a substitute. It wasn't for that substitute. It was for the actual classroom teacher that this child drew this. And at the time, again, if you're in a survival state, it doesn't matter who you are. You're in a survival state. You're doing what you need to do to survive. And if you've been dealing with a lot of stuff, you may be missing some steps along the way. So the principal spoke to the child, spoke to the parent, talked about how incorrect this was. Social worker spoke to the child, and the day ended. The next day, teacher comes, the teacher that was what this child had drawn, who the mm-hmm. child had drawn about, comes back to school, and their colleagues tell them what happened. Nobody had told that teacher what happened. So mm-hmm. teacher starts the day finding this out from peers. Well, boom, amygdala is hijacked. They are not feeling safe. They go to talk to the principal. They are like, I am going to the police. I am pressing charges. This is a direct threat. All of these different things. So at that point, it escalates to more people being involved to find out How do we, because now the teacher doesn't want this child in their classroom. They, all of these things are there. And, you know, the child, it becomes about their whole story. And meanwhile, we're in a space of, like, the administrators involved are in the space of, how do we keep everyone that's involved safe and ready to be present for their work, for their class, et cetera. And so right away, they do some backpedaling of and going back to some procedural things that could be done. They do a risk assessment on the child to see whether or not this child is a risk to themselves or other people. They, you know, talk to the parent. We do a domain meeting. Parent is an agreement to start domain, start an evaluation process. We do all these things. We put in, and this was towards the end of the year. So we put in VA, we adjusted adult support to that classroom, to that, for that teacher and that child. So there was a teaching assistant in that space. And we, and this was a child who did not have special ed services already. So then we add in, can we get consent for social work services during this time period? And all of those pieces got put into place. Meanwhile, the thing that did not get put into place was the repair of that relationship between that teacher and that child. And so that teacher then, whether it was intentional or not, was very heightened and dysregulated for the remainder of that year. And it was towards the end of the year, very cautious around being around that child. That completely made sense.
Yeah.
At that point in time, I was still learning about restorative, and I would have approached that completely different had I better understood how to do that. Because in my mind, this was still a child, right? Like, in the grand scheme of things, this was still a child. And this child's development was going to then be shaped around their BAT. Because here's what happened. This was towards the end of the year. Child gets, you know, qualified for services. Child does not start the next grade level with everyone else. And we call the parent, try to find out why. Child's been hospitalized because the child was anticipating going into school being perceived as bad. So that child carried around all summer, I am bad, that state of being, I am bad. Not, unfortunately, I made a mistake and I need to apologize and repair. But now is walking around as I am bad. So was hospitalized because there were thoughts of suicidal, like the child was looking at and considering harming themselves because of the situation.
So really not having the opportunity to repair a relationship in that particular situation appeared to be something that was internalized. So the, like, you're almost saying that for the people who are the ones that, you know, make the poor decision or do, are the ones that initiate whatever the behavior was, that it's actually restorative for them to be able to go through that process of repairing the relationship with the other person.
Right. Because in this particular case, the neither felt safe.
Mm-hmm.
One didn't feel safe because of shame and because they perceive themselves as I made this mistake and therefore everyone's going to see me as bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. The other one is I don't feel safe because no one's supporting me. There's an abandonment that occurred. And now I have to practice self-care, but no organizational care is occurring here.
Yeah.
To make sure that I'm okay.
So really the restorative piece is allowing both the person who made the poor choice of their behavior gets to repair it, but then also the person who is on the other side on the receiving end gets to have the support that they need to feel safe to continue to have that relationship or at least be in a shared space with them.
Right. And I think what's really important is I want to make sure that this is clear. There are going to be extremes of significant harm that's been done that it may not be appropriate for a restorative in this way because
it's
unsafe, right? So when I'm talking about restorative right now, I'm talking about those situations in which repair is attempted to create healthy communities. So that's
appropriate. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right. You know, like a student stole someone's wallet.
Mm-hmm.
That's frustrating. You want to try to repair that situation. Yeah. You
know? Or somebody was snarky to their teacher and talked back, or even this is the special ed director who used to do the CPI training would even talk about. So for kids who are learning to self-regulate, even how you handle cussing in class, that somebody just yelling out a cuss word due to frustration is different than somebody going up and physically threatening somebody and like saying something or even doing something physically to someone in addition to swearing at them, that is, you know, somebody having an outburst, but then catching themselves and reeling themselves back is a completely different situation than something more severe.
Right. So like, for example, I had a student who they were upset and they took a rubber band and they went bing. And when they did it, they hit the teacher right here, like right above, like right below their eye, yeah, right the cheekbone. That child's face was like, oh, like,
yeah, immediate recognition,
immediate recognition of harm. That teacher who had been working with children with disabilities for years could tell by that immediate response that it was not intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, with any situation, our intention does not always match our impact.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to, with the social worker, the three of them were able to repair it because that person knew that child didn't mean it. That child knew they made a mistake in that moment because it was, for whatever reason, the child was dysregulated, flung it, and boom, it just happened to hit. And mm-hmm. so that's sometimes what students do is they do something and they're not even, again, they're not thinking.
It's like the impulsivity and then it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it's like, whoa, I got to pull back. And how do I repair? Because children don't know necessarily how to do that. And so they're going to take one of two options. They're either going to fight, you know, well, fight, flight, or freeze for sure. Or, you know, they're going to try to accept it. But in order for them to accept it, they need to know how to do that. And that's where teaching and modeling is so important. Mm-hmm. So you made a mistake. How do I fix it? Because none of us are the sum of our mistakes.
Yeah.
Like we all make mistakes and sometimes more than others. And how do we move past those mistakes that we've made? And wouldn't we want to be able to teach children how to do that? Children with disabilities, particularly children with invisible disabilities, the message that they're getting is something is wrong with them. And therefore, they may not necessarily be contributing meaningfully. So by the time junior high hits, there are times where kids will reject social work, they'll reject speech. They've either been bullied for their lisp or their stuttering, and they don't want to keep working on something anymore because that therapist, whether is intentional or not, is symbolic to them of something's wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Going to a resource room or going to, that means something's wrong with them. So who wants to have that reinforced? So how do we help children understand that we all have strengths, we all have areas that we need to grow in? There's this, I'll share it with you. I don't know if you've seen it. It's the neurodivergent checklist. Mm-hmm. And it's all these different abilities. So it's not just academic, but all these things that are skills that children could have as strengths. Mm-hmm. And I bring that up because when you're in a restorative space, there are times in which you can pull from strengths to help model how to move forward in something. The child who did this with the gun drawing, where it escalated, I mean, there's so many layers to that story. It was heartbreaking, yeah, and a mess. Was really very creative individual and was also deeply feeling. Like when they made an error, they felt that error.
Mm-hmm. And they probably didn't know how to repair it.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the parent was struggling with wanting to save their child.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I think that when there's not a consequence or a And I say consequence, meaning like, I don't mean punishment, but like you do something, something happens as a result of your behavior and the choices that you make. So even just the consequence being the debrief or cleaning up the situation. I know that sometimes consequence is another one of those words that gets, it's, people think it's punishment, but no, it's a consequence. And sometimes it's something that you don't like, but it's just something that happens. And so I think that that is, that gets a little bit, can go too far in the other direction as well, because if you don't, if there isn't a consequence or you're not guided through the consequence, then you can't repair it, or you don't learn how to regulate the behaviors on the front end to, for when you're going to be in a situation where you're not in school anymore and people aren't going to be there to support you. And they're not going to be understanding of, you know, whatever it is that you're going through.
We haven't even talked about this, and I'm sure we could talk about all these different things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about trauma and, you know, the active school shooter drills, that debriefing, that should happen every time after you do those.
After the drills
with all children, there should not be any times where you just kind of go, oh, business as usual, because there's nothing normal about having to do that. Mm-hmm. And I know that that might be like, well, wait, we're trying to keep it. You're right. You are trying to keep people safe. But at the same time, are we numbing to the fact that that's a real threat? And for some people, that threat gets, that's a re-triggering event for people. So you're doing an active shooter drill in a space without having context around whether or not those children have ever been in a situation, whether or not those adults have ever been in a situation that was real. And if you don't do a debrief, if you haven't trained your staff to do a debrief with their students, then are we really setting the stage for a safe school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about even fire drill, tornado drill?
Right. Like environmental disasters are real. Those can be traumatic experiences. Obviously, you know, school shootings, which unfortunately we know have occurred, those are very real. How do we help to recognize that we're in a community and to keep us safe?
Yeah.
And it's about talking it through. And I know that's not easy. I know it's uncomfortable. I will say, though, that if you can talk through that and work through it, it builds stronger connections versus avoiding. Because when we avoid, we go into a space of meaning making that sometimes is really assumptions. So like one of the things we talk about in our adult SEL, and we've actually talked about it in another COP, is the ladder of inference, because that is our brain trying to make meaning out of something. So, you know, an example, there's this TED Talk video, it's like 5 minutes, that talks about the ladder of inference. And it goes through and like, here's this person driving who's going to go in and go into a parking spot that's empty, but somebody cuts them off and takes the spot. Well, this, the ladder of inference is within seconds. So this person sees this person happen, they're angry, they may yell something at that person because they're thinking, they're going off of their own beliefs. This person is rude. This, like, you're making judgments. This person is rude. This person has done this, like, and all of these things, because now they feel disrespected. And you're coming up against having to react and defend yourself. Well, then what happens when that person comes out of their car and they come up to you and go, I'm really sorry. You know, in this example, they go, yeah, I'm really sorry. My wife is in labor. She called me from the mall. I have to go in and try to get her to the hospital. Well, now you've just been given new information that is letting your brain know, you went into, you know, you were thinking there was a tiger there and there's no tiger.
Yeah.
And now you're going to respond differently.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the coping mechanisms to be able to regulate from fight or flight to the frontal lobe, because a lot of adults don't at times.
Yeah.
And we're seeing this. I mean, it's not just schools. Like, what are we seeing in the last like 5 to 10 years? If you go into a doctor's office or a hospital, you will see signs posted that have not been posted before. These are healing spaces. Certain behaviors will not be tolerated. And we're having to set the expectation for adults to understand, coming into a space dysregulated, attempting to release whatever frustrations you have in a way on people who don't know why you're frustrated and are doing the best they can will not be expected, because we also have to be able to model for children how to manage strong emotions.
Oh, so much. We could keep going. But we've talked to about a bunch of different things, and I've been writing down some of the resources that you mentioned. But is there anything else that you want to share with people before we wrap up here, as far as just where they can learn about the work you're doing or just resources that you've mentioned so far?
Yeah. So there are a couple of different things. Like I mentioned, the Elena Aguilar podcast. You can go on to Spotify, Apple, any of those places where podcasts are. It's the Bright Morning podcast. And there's three episodes on, coaching through resistance, I think are really helpful and impactful. Okay. For the REACH initiative, which I'm involved in, there is the Center for Childhood Resilience website. Mm-hmm. And it also has, there are free learning resources on the Learning and Resource Hub that's affiliated with the Center for Childhood Resilience. And that is, the Learning and Resource Hub has things on introduction to trauma, you know, classroom management strategies, trauma, racism, and equity. And there are different learnings that people can do, and they're available to anyone. So you can sign up, it's free, and there are available learnings to anyone. Which I think is really important to have access to. And then, you know, in terms of my work, it's the partnershipforresilience.org, and that's our website. And we you'll see the different things that we do and the work that we do there, because the REACH initiative is one initiative that we work on, but we do community, we do community work in which we'll talk about like how stress can impact your body, you know, and like hypertension, diabetes, all those medical conditions that kind of come into play. We also work on career readiness, you know, so we look at cradle to career and helping to support children. So there's some different work there. But I would say, you know, one of the biggest pieces is like when we're thinking about that regulating, co-regulating, when we're working through things, you know, really understanding like the sphere of influence, what is it that we know that is ours to do? Because compassion fatigue, we're carrying things that aren't ours. And there are only, recognizing that there are limitations to what we can do. And as much as we don't want to admit that, we do as much as we can to support. And at the same time, recognizing we can't carry it all.
Yeah.
And also letting go of the result. Like we are looking for this particular outcome. And sometimes that outcome comes later. Like this child, one of the children that I was telling you about, the one that they were looking at, an alternative placement, that incredible young man who I developed a wonderful relationship with just graduated from college is becoming a nurse and is doing amazing things. I didn't see that. I would not have known that at the end of their eighth grade experience. So I had to let go of the result and hope that what I was guiding and doing was going to work. But also really having a strong network of support, not only necessarily a network at your school community, but also within your community itself. And having some self-care strategies, but really, I think it's important for administrators and staff to come together and go, how do we create an organizational culture that cares for one another? Really asking that question. And I think that's important. And there's some resources on the Learning and Resource Hub. My organization, the Partnership for Resilience, does work with schools and districts to do that, because this isn't easy work. And the reality is, if you're looking and you're centering academics, because that is something that did happen after the pandemic, people said, we're going to focus on social emotional learning. And they did maybe for the first month. And as soon as those MAP scores kind of came out, it pivoted back to academics, because that's default. We default to what we know, what we're familiar with. In order to really disrupt that pattern, that cycle, even with any behavior, in order to disrupt it, you have to put something new in its place. And we know that in order for academics to improve and grow and thrive, you want the plate of social emotional learning to be available and ready to sustain it. So I think those are some things to really think about and consider when moving forward with this work.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you. It was great. I appreciated the time, and I'm glad we got a chance to connect and talk about
it. Yeah, it was great. So much good stuff here.
Be sure to check the show notes for all of the links to the resources we mentioned in this conversation, and be sure to listen to episode 152, the first part of my conversation with Chrissy, where we talk about the cost of caring and compassion fatigue. And then finally, if you want a comprehensive plan for putting executive functioning support in place on your school team, then check out the School of Clinical Leadership. I'll show you how to support students' executive functioning for direct intervention, but then I'll also give you the tools you need to make sure it's embedded throughout their day. To learn more about the program, go to drkarendudekbrandon.com/clinical leadership. If you have a suggestion for a guest, or if you're interested in being a guest on De Facto Leaders, please send me an email at talktome@drkarenspeech.com. As always, it helps me so much if you share the De Facto Leaders podcast with your friends, or if you leave me a rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments without just teaching to the test? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/BE to learn how IXL's research-based teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's IXL.com/BE. There are lots of solutions out there for giving students what they need when they need it. But when do they actually do all of those things? You need flexible time. When added into the master schedule, flex time enables students to get extra help or intervention, meet with teachers, make up work, get physical exercise, and try new enrichment offerings. If you're thinking of giving it a try, check out My Flex Learning, which unlocks the benefits of flex time without the common challenges. Its intuitive design makes implementation and training a breeze. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off your first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE.